in Paulsboro, New Jersey, after a train derailment sent tank cars with vinyl chloride off a bridge into the Mantua Creek on November 30th. Hundreds of residents were evacuated, and after a series of tests, most were told over the weekend that it was safe enough to go back home. But while life is slowly getting back to normal in Paulsboro, many questions and concerns remain about railroad safety, the shipment of hazardous material, aging infrastructure, and the responsibilities of freight companies to maintain and inspect their rail lines. So today on Radio Times, what lessons need to be learned from this accident, which shed light on the important role of the freight railroad system that it plays in the U.S. economy. And we have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studios is Paul Nussbaum. He's a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, covering the Paulsboro train accident, and basically covers transportation for the paper. And Paul, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. On the telephone is Peter Swan, an assistant professor of logistics and operations management at Penn State Harrisburg. He's been a member of the Penn State faculty since 1998, and his work focuses on transportation and supply chain management. And Peter Swan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Morning, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Let me begin with you, if I could. Paul, help us understand Paulsboro, New Jersey. What does this little town look like?
Paulsboro is a working-class town. As in so many working-class towns in America, it's the scene of a lot of industrial activity. It's close to a number of chemical plants and refineries, which is why the train was down there in the first place. And we should note that Paulsboro is also famous for its high school wrestling team. They've got a state championship high school wrestling team that's always, you know, making news about Paulsboro. So that's one of the things that Paulsboro is best known for, right?
And do we know what happened? And I've been reading a lot of your articles, other people's articles as well, and it looks like there were several pretty serious mistakes that led to this derailment. What do we know now?
Well, clearly the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, is still investigating, and they won't come out with their report for many months yet. But what they've said and what's become clear, you know, in the days after the accident is there were several things that happened. Probably the most crucial was that the train crossed the bridge even though it had a red signal telling it not to go. It didn't make that trip across the bridge until a conductor had visually gotten off and inspected the bridge and had gotten permission from the train dispatcher to proceed. However, in hindsight, that clearly looks like a bad call.
Right.
Also, the bridge had a number of problems in the recent years, recent months, even recent days. It was known to Conrail to have problems. The bridge had failed in 2009. More recently, there had been reports from crews that had gone over the tracks that there were problems, and it was a very old bridge. It was built originally in 1873. A lot of the mechanism was still from that era.
Really?
So it operates like a garden gate. It swings open and closed to allow water traffic and then closes for train traffic.
You mentioned a previous accident. This was 2009. There was a derailment of 9 coal cars.
Those were coal cars. And so we didn't hear a lot about it at the time. It didn't cause evacuations. It didn't cause the kind of uproar that this did. But the bridge had to be fixed. Right. Then the train cars had to be put back on the tracks. And eventually, you know, business right. proceeded as usual.
I guess what and I'll get to you, Peter, in just a moment or two. But what makes this such a serious situation is the leakage of this toxic flammable material in the train cars.
Right, right. If it hadn't been vinyl chloride, and if it hadn't ruptured, people probably wouldn't have been nearly as alarmed as right. they are. But you've got a toxic chemical, a carcinogen, a flammable chemical in the air and in the water, and that forced the evacuation and the very careful and arduous mm-hmm. cleanup afterwards.
And how many people were evacuated when all was said and done?
I think the number was about 700 wow. Residents, and I think most of those, probably about 600, are back in their homes over the weekend.
But I guess those closest to the creek, not quite yet.
Right. I think there are still about 100 families that have not been permitted to go back in.
Peter Swan, let me get you in on the conversation, and I have several questions. One is, we're talking about a bridge that was built in 1873, and I know that there are thousands of bridges across the country used by the railroad freight industry, and I guess passenger rail as well. Should we be surprised that a bridge that old is still being used so much?
Well, it is pretty old.
Yes, it is.
But I will tell you, these movable bridges over waterways in particular are generally the ones you're going to find that are much older, because the cost of replacing them is much more than the cost of replacing a bridge that doesn't move. And, you know, another place where you'll see many movable bridges that are hideously old is on the Amtrak line. And Amtrak's just now getting to replacing some of their old movable bridges on the Northeast Corridor.
But would it be fair to say that looking at and we're speaking largely about freight traffic, railroad freight trains, Peter Swan, is that we're talking about trains that are much heavier, probably longer than those used in the 19th century?
Sure. And most of the bridges that are this old have been reinforced in some way to handle the heavier loads. You know, so you don't see them this old that often. But what happens in the railroad industry, because the infrastructure is self-financed, if the profits from the line aren't sufficient to replace infrastructure, then they basically maintain it in perpetuity until they can, you know, no longer afford to service the line or make enough money to replace structures like these.
So were you surprised to learn that there have been concerns, even a derailment a couple of years ago, and concerns within the last year, within the last couple of weeks, about this particular bridge? Peter?
Well, you know, I personally, I'd like to wait for the NTSB report to come out to say exactly what failed and why, to say there were, you know, serious concerns all along. But it is telling that they had a 10-mile-per-hour speed limit on the bridge. That's saying that it's not a structure that is very robust, and, you know, one maybe there should be some worry about. I know that the Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission was trying to get a grant for replacing this very structure in the near future.
What's interesting, though, and perhaps troubling, perhaps not, but let me start with you, Peter Swan, which is that, for instance, in this instance, Conrail is essentially responsible for the cost, but or probably will be, or maybe they won't be, I don't know, but have been responsible for the maintenance, the inspection of the bridges and the rail lines that they use, I guess, rather than, what, government or outside agencies?
Yeah, and, you know, this is an issue that came up when I was looking at container chassis as well. Trucking firms also inspect their own equipment, and people say, why isn't the government inspecting it? And I think there's several good reasons. For railroad infrastructure in particular, each of these bridges is different. It's not like there's one type of bridge that's all the same. So whoever the inspector is has to have knowledge of the specific bridge they're looking at. Additionally, you have to coordinate the operations of the trains with the maintenance and the inspection. And the railroads, you know, because they manage the trains, it's very easy for them to also manage the inspectors as well. And, you know, let me add one other thing.
Go ahead.
Government's got no lock on not making mistakes with maintenance and inspection in particular. You know, if you look at the bridge in Minneapolis, I-35W, I believe it was, that collapsed a while back. Now, there was a design flaw. The contractor was allowed to put too much weight on the bridge, but it was also clear that the inspections had not been up to snuff in that state for a while. And so, you know, it makes sense to say, well, it's you know, the railroads have a conflict of interest, but in reality they don't, because they have to pay for the cleanup of this accident, they have to pay for their equipment that's damaged, and so they have a vested interest in making sure that their infrastructure is up to the task of moving the trains.
Well, let me just jump in here. Paul Nussbaum, is that how it works out, that if there is a problem, that the industry, in a sense, pays for and deals with the problem itself?
Well, that's supposed to be how it works. That's true. But there's only a finite amount of money, obviously. I mean, Conrail is owned by CSX and Norfolk Southern, and they're profit-making corporations, of course, and they only have X amount of money for their entire systems, for the bridges, for the rails, for everything. And so I guess it's always a question of what do you fix now, what do you postpone until later if you can. And so, you know, without anybody telling them what they have to fix and when they have to fix it. It really is largely left up to their self-interest.
There was a news item a month or two ago before the accident in Paulsboro that there was something like $18.5 million in federal stimulus money to be used to improve freight lines in what sounds like, Paul Nussbaum, the area that we've been talking about.
It's the general area, not this bridge, not
right.
this line, but a very nearby line and another movable bridge, a much bigger movable bridge, the Del Air Bridge that goes across the Delaware River.
What does it take? And I wonder for you, Peter Swan, as much as you know about this particular bridge, what do you think it would cost or take to rebuild it? And perhaps even a swing bridge is not appropriate for the 21st century.
Oh, I think a swing bridge or some sort of movable bridge is appropriate, but it would be, you know, several millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. I'm not an engineer, so I'm the wrong person to ask, but I would, you know, guess it could be $40 million or upwards of that.
In order to get this back to running, and does that square with your numbers, Paul Nussbaum?
Well, probably the most recent estimates have been about $20 million for this bridge and a very similar bridge about 7 miles away in Bridgeport, New Jersey. That's the amount that the recent Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission report had in it to replace those two bridges was $40 million total.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable to me.
And Peter Swan, if a train car is carrying toxic material, as this one was, are there special ways that these cars are built in order to prevent the kind of spillage that happened in Paulsboro?
Yes. There typically is a container within the tank car. The ones that haul LPG and whatnot have shields at the end of the car to prevent puncturing. The couplers are shelf couplers to keep the cars coupled together as much as possible in the derailment. And, you know, the standards for these particular cars continue to be updated as we learn, you know, more and more about how they react. You know, and I'll tell you also, hazardous materials are an interesting problem for the railroads because they're well aware of their liability in hauling these goods. And there was one railroad, Union Pacific, which tried to set their rates to force shippers to use the shortest shipment possible when routing hazardous materials to minimize their liability. And they were unable to do that because they're a common carrier under the laws of the in the Constitution. So this is something that they're looking at. I will tell you, in working with private car fleet owners like Dow and others, they watch the management, the safety of their fleet very closely. And, you know, a couple of things they look at is unintended releases either at their plants or by derailments. And those numbers have been going down and down and down for many years, and it got to the point when we were running this group, benchmarking group, a couple years ago.
Hold on to that thought, Peter Swan, only because we're coming up on a very short break, and then we'll be right back. Stay with us.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. PAFA Continuing Education invites you to join their community of artists of all ages and levels this spring, featuring day, evening, and weekend art classes, pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, art appreciation in the PAFA Museum, and master workshops with noted artists. Registration is now open, and classes begin January 22nd. For details, pafa.edu/CE.
Let's talk numbers. Over the past 3 years, WHYY has seen a 48% decline in government funding. That's unrestricted funds we could use to pay NPR and PBS for the programs you love and produce original programs like Radio Times. Over 50% of our yearly budget comes from listeners like you. Explore the ways you can support WHYY by visiting whyy.org/support.
Yuck, they're greasy.
I know, Michael said. They're not as good as my mom's.
A fourth grader fries his own latkes and cooks up a small miracle. And an uncertain young life is mysteriously redirected. I'm Susan Stamberg. Join me and Murray Horowitz for the 2012 edition of Hanukkah Lights from NPR.
tonight at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The freight train derailment on November 30th in Paulsboro, New Jersey, that sent tank cars carrying a toxic material called vinyl chloride into the creek has raised some serious questions about railroad safety, regulation, and maintenance. We're talking about all of this with Peter Swan, Assistant Professor of Logistics and Operations Management at Penn State Harrisburg, and Paul Nussbaum, who's been covering the story for the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he's a staff writer. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And we would particularly love to hear from people living in and around Paulsboro. Do give us a call. Peter, I had a jump in and cut you off because we were up on our break here. Can you just quickly pick up where you left off?
Yeah, I got a little long-winded.
That's okay.
Basically, the statistics of releases of chemicals have been trending down and down and down for several decades, as have derailments for the rail industry as well. And the industry is safer now than I think it's ever been for the public and for employees. And I would also say that, in general, the track is better now than it's ever been as well.
Let me go back to you, Paul, and even going back to Paulsboro, because this material that we're talking about was released into the water and also into the air. What do we know about vinyl chloride?
Most people may not recognize the name, but it's a very common material that's used in making PVC pipe, and that's used in home construction, in commercial construction. It has other uses as well. It's a plastic. It's used in making plastics.
And how much of it, do we know how much of it was leaked either into the water or what the air quality was at least shortly after the accident?
I don't know what the numbers are either in the total release or in the parts per million that were measured down there. The tanker, I believe, was capable and was carrying 30,000 gallons, most of which remained in the tank car and had to be pumped out carefully as part of the removal process. But enough clearly escaped that there was the evacuation of the 700 people.
Go ahead, Peter Swan.
Well, and reading the stats on this chemical, I'm not in the industry, but it seemed the greater danger was explosion and fire than actual release of the chemical and breathing it.
It is very flammable. That's right. That's a good point. It's volatile. And so in addition to being a carcinogen, it's a hazardous explosive chemical.
And even going back to at least to what we know, Paul, about the decision to go across this bridge, there was a red light. Someone went out and looked, inspected the tracks, and it looked like okay to them. But they had to get permission from, a dispatcher?
That's right, a dispatcher who's not on the scene but is up in Mount Laurel, I believe. The rules require that if they encounter a red signal and are not able to get the green signal through the usual electronic procedure, then in order to cross the bridge, they have to, a qualified employee is the language in the rules, a qualified employee has to make an inspection of the, or an examination of the bridge. And if the examination appears to indicate that the bridge is safe, then to get permission from the dispatcher to cross the bridge. And that's certainly not unheard of. It happens because there are signal malfunctions or there can be other kinds of glitches.
Sure.
But in this case, there had been enough recent forewarnings, including the last train that had gone over this bridge had encountered a problem, so that perhaps it was not the best thing to go ahead and proceed across the bridge against the red signal.
And the importance of the red signal, Peter Swan?
Well, generally they mean stop, and there's kind of two generic types of red signals in the railroad. Some are called absolute, where you have to get permission of dispatcher to go past them, and some there you can stop and proceed, and I won't get into all the technical details.
Right.
But this one in particular, let me say generically, it happens every day where a dispatcher will give a crew permission by a red signal. Typically, it's where you work in a yard and come back and then couple back to your train. Because your train's occupying the block that the signal protects, it's always red, and you get permission to go back. But here you have a movable, what's called a movable bridge. and that signal not just says whether the track is clear, but also whether the locking mechanisms have engaged, because clearly you don't want a train going across mm-hmm. that bridge if the locking mechanisms are not engaged. And the one thing about this that made me really queasy from the railroad's point of view is the dispatcher giving the train crew permission across, knowing how this bridge operates and knowing its history. I don't know what the root cause will be from the NTSB, but that's probably going to be a contributing factor.
Paul, one of your descriptions was the train crossing the bridge, and I guess behind it, the bridge beginning to collapse.
Well, that was the train crew's description as the to the NTSB was that after the first locomotives and the first few cars crossed the bridge, their words were that the bridge began to collapse. If you look at the pictures after the fact, it doesn't look like it really collapsed so much as went out of line, and maybe the front part of it fell into the water. It's unclear exactly how much of the bridge collapsed. It certainly failed. But, the bridge didn't function the way it was supposed to, obviously.
And that's Paul Nussbaum, staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, has been covering the Paulsboro train accident for the paper. Peter Swan from Penn State Harrisburg joining us as well. And Coast Guard Captain Kathy Moore is with us. She's of the Unified Command overseeing the debris removal in Mantua Creek in Paulsboro, New Jersey. And Kathy Moore, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. How many of the residents of Paulsboro have been able to return home?
Everybody, with the exception of the residents associated with about 11 homes, very much adjacent to the creek. Everybody else has been allowed to return home. Air monitoring has been completed on all of the homes that were in the evacuated area, as well as a large number of homes that were outside of the evacuated area where people had concerns. We've had no detections of vinyl chloride in any home or any business to date.
And what will you need in order for those final residents to go home?
We really have been focusing on this effort to be able to say that all of the vinyl chloride cars are out of the way and out of the water and are secured before those residents come back home, because their homes are right on the creek.
And there are still some cars in the creek.
Yes. At this point, we still have a number of cars in the creek. There's two vinyl chloride cars that are in the creek itself. There's also an ethanol car that's still in the creek.
And how are you going to get them out of the creek?
The process to lift them out will be a process that involves rigging with cables and slings in the cars that are in the water. Part of that is an underwater dive operation in the creek as well. And then a 150-ton crane that's on site will be lifting those cars and then landing them to some deck barges that are going to be prepared to be able to receive them.
And how many divers do you have involved in this this mission?
The total number of divers, I'm not sure, but we have the divers that are in the water, and then for every diver in the water, there is one standby safety diver. There's a dive supervisor, so there's a dive safety boat, and then there is a completely removed from the diving operations a backup dive safety boat. So anybody gets in trouble, there's a number of people that and processes that go into place to recover them.
And when do you hope to start pulling these tank cars out?
We're to the place where now we're finishing up today phase two, which has been site preparation. We finished removing the pilings associated with protecting the bridge structure as well as bridge fendering, and we've also repositioned the crane barge into its location now where it's going to make the first lift. Next, as far as today, we're preparing the deck barges and securing the rail cars, especially that breached car, so that we can remove some of the structure of the bridge, that A-frame that you may have seen in pictures.
Yes.
That's got to be removed before that first pick can be made. That first lift is going to be our breached car. One of the things we have to do with that when we're rigging it, the good news is no dive operations associated with rigging that car. But we do have to pull the gray car that has the bolster, that support structure inside the breached car. Mm. We have to pull those two apart, and then we safely lift the breached car and land it on a rail car, on a deck barge.
And how much water contamination was there?
We have had some detections in the parts per billion category very, very early in the response, up to day three or so. We started measuring as soon as we possibly could upstream and downstream from the incident. And then we sent those results off to a laboratory. I don't have them in my head, but in the parts per billion, certainly no concern in terms of the environment. We've also been continuing with water sampling and sediment sampling and soil sampling.
And are you concerned that this extraction process could risk another spill?
We have a lot of all of the rigging is being supervised by people very familiar with the train cars, and that salvage rail cars from land situations for a living. So we have the right tool in place. The Weeks crane that we have, the 150-ton crane, is a tremendous tool. You may have heard that this is the company that removed the plane from the Hudson. We have what's called a Neptune system. It's a water fog system that where there's to be any release of vinyl chloride, it would water fog the area and help to pull the vapors down out of the air into the water. We have a tremendous number of other safety backup systems. So we've really tried as much as possible to reduce the risk, but in all honesty, we are lifting a car, rail car, out of the water and through the air and landing it on a deck barge. It's a very delicate operation, and it is not free from risk, but we have all of the safety measures in place to do it safely.
Have you ever done this before, you yourself?
I have never actually worked rail cars before. I have worked a number of salvage operations that involved freeing vessels, barges, and ships from some very precarious locations, doing a lot of lifting and rigging. So I have a lot of oversight experience with that regard.
So where will you be when you start taking these tank cars out of the creek?
My job is overall incident management, so I spend most of my time in the command post. The guys have been very gracious in terms of whenever I wanted to go down to the site to continue to be able to describe the site and some of the things involved, but I try to stay out of the hands-on management at the site because that's certainly not my job. My job is mostly the oversight part.
And is this really a creek in the way that we think of a creek?
It certainly is not. It's this Manchuit Creek, as it's called, is a tributary of the Delaware River, but it is in every respect a river to be respected. The local residents have said to me that they see whirlpools in it under normal circumstances. The creek is 15 to 20 feet deep. It is necked down in this area so that locally, without any obstructions in the water, we see about a 5-foot tide change and about a 6-knot current. But now that we've put rail cars in the water between high and low tide, we see and low and high tide, we see essentially on the one side of the wreck, the water falls about a foot till it gets to the other side of the wreck, and we have swirling whirlpools. We have a tremendous amount of gurgling. We have video on the response website because it's just so extreme, and that really limits our ability to dive. Our slack time, we were able to insert a NOAA tide and current meter earlier this week or over the weekend, and get data from that tells us that our slack periods, that period during the high and low tide peaks, are only about an hour. And that's really a very constrained timeline to be able to do diving safely. But other than that, it is pretty much a rushing river.
Well, on that note, I know you're very busy, and we wish you and your team the best of luck. Kathy Moore, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. She's Coast Guard Captain Kathy Moore of the United Command, overseeing the removal of just not debris, but also some of these tank cars that have fallen into the creek in Paulsboro, New Jersey. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. And staying with us for the rest of the hour, Peter Swan and Paul Nussbaum, just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Paul, anything that she said that struck you?
I think it indicates clearly why it's taking so long. And a lot of people are very frustrated that it's taken as long as it has. But her description of the creek and the impediments to safely moving the cars makes sense that they don't want to compound things by going too quickly, as frustrating as it may be to the folks that live there.
Anything you want to add, Peter Swan, then we'll get to our callers.
Well, it's kind of interesting. There's two companies, Hulcher and Corman, that typically will clean up railroad derailments, and I guess they're assisting, but they don't have the technology, the expertise for doing it in water.
For doing in water, the uniqueness of this particular accident. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Wayne from Pensauken joining us on Radio Times. And Wayne, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I have to, as a former freight conductor who ran over that bridge hundreds of times, I have to come to the defense of the Conrail conductor. He did exactly, from what I understand, exactly what he was supposed to do. In fact, I think he went beyond the call of duty because he placed his life in jeopardy by going out on that bridge. That bridge may have collapsed under his weight. Who knows? I guess we won't know until the investigation is over. A conductor is placed in a very difficult position in that situation because in order for him to have refused to cross that bridge, he would have had to have had a definite safety danger in mind. Because if he had refused to cross that bridge, immediately the company would have sent a train master out there who would have asked him why he was refusing to move the train. And if he couldn't point to a specific safety hazard, he would be taken out of service immediately, which amounts to being fired, and they would hold him out, have a trial in a week, 2 weeks, a month, and you know, for an average working guy, you can't afford that. Well, so a lot, there are times when you question things, but you do as you're told. The second thing is...
Well, wait, Wayne, hold on 1 second, only because I'm looking at the clock and I do want to get our guests to respond. But you said you have gone over that bridge. Did you have concerns about it?
I never had concerns about it because there was always a bridge tender when I went over that bridge.
There was a human being that basically...
Yes, exactly.
Well, you know, hold on to that thought because I want to go back to Paul Nussbaum because one of the things, again, that you wrote in the Inquirer was that there was a person whose job it was to monitor the bridge. That position was removed a couple of years ago.
I'm not sure exactly how long ago, but like the caller says, until relatively recent times, there was a human that did the job that's now done by automation, opened and closed the bridge and made sure that it was locked in place to save money and to avoid having to have a person there all the time. Conrail and its parent companies replaced that with this automated system. And so now there isn't a person that's very familiar with the bridge and its locking system. And like the caller says, the conductor is only doing what he's told to do, making that visual examination, but he can't see from the top of the rails the locking system underneath. So he's caught between a rock and a hard place.
And Wayne, we have about 45 seconds before saying goodbye. And can you make your second point really quickly?
One other point, when the bridge tender was there, the bridge tender operated two signals on either end of the bridge, which were called smashboards. They were yellow banjo-type signals that dropped down over the rail. And if this automated system had been hooked up to a system like that, the train would have never crossed the bridge because the locomotive would have to break through the smashboard in order to cross the bridge, and that accident wouldn't have happened.
Well, Wayne,
this is a question of human beings overriding technology.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm going to give Peter Swan a chance to respond to that after this very short break, and that was Wayne calling us from Pensauken. We are talking about the freight train derailment on Friday, November 30th in Paulsboro, New Jersey. It's raised a whole host of questions about toxic material and also railroad safety, and our guests are Peter Swan, Assistant Professor of Logistics and Operations Management at Penn State Harrisburg campus. Also with us, Paul Nussbaum, staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, has been covering the story for the paper. One open line at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Winter Tour presents A Feast for the Eyes, a holiday tour of Henry Francis DuPont's ancestral home, now through January 6th. Tours will showcase Winter Tour's traditional holiday displays, featuring interiors bedecked in holiday finery and decorated trees, including the dried flower tree, a Yuletide tradition, plus special exhibitions, shopping, and dining. Yuletide at Winter Tour. Reservations and details at 800-448-3883 or wintertour.org. Winter Tour proudly supports WHYY.
Congress is debating what to cut and what to keep to avoid the fiscal cliff. But what would happen to your financial picture if tax write-offs for mortgage interest and charitable donations come to an end? We start our series looking at fixes for the fiscal cliff and ask, why not? Next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Most children subjected to sexual abuse feel great shame. For male victims, shame can be front and center, so much so that their stories are often untold. After all, how does a grown man reveal this part of his life? And if he does, is help available? On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, stories of male survivors, how they're recovering and thriving. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the train derailment in Paulsboro, New Jersey on November 30th and the questions and concerns it raises about railroad safety, the shipment of hazardous material, aging infrastructure, and the responsibilities of freight companies to maintain and inspect their rail lines. Our guests are Paul Nussbaum and Peter Swan, and just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Peter, our caller, Wayne, talked about a person at this bridge whose job it was essentially to allow trains to go over it, and with, I guess, intimate knowledge of that bridge. Do we need more tenders?
Well, the reason we don't have a tender is there's a lot of competition in the freight industry, and they're trying to reduce costs. You could say, yeah, if we had a tender, this wouldn't have happened. It's probably true, and I don't disagree with anything Wayne said, except that the dispatcher made a decision to tell the crew to cross, and we'll wait for the NTSB to know exactly what happened here. But I suspect that one of the outcomes will be, if there isn't a rule saying the dispatcher shouldn't give permission to cross on a movable bridge like this when they can't get a signal, that there will be in the future.
You've been writing, Paul, about the fact that at least there's one lawsuit. I don't know if there'll be more, but they're starting to come in.
There is one. I think we can bet safely that there will be more. The first lawsuit seeks in excess of $10 million in punitive damages, and that's probably what we'll see in the future, is people seeking compensation for injuries and also seeking to punish, if you will, the railroad for violating rules.
And the kind of, I guess, stress and concern that can come with an evacuation, for instance.
Right. The compensation would be for the injuries, physical, mental, nervous system, all of that. But the big numbers, lawsuits are obviously seeking punitive damages as well.
Peter Swan, I was doing some reading over the weekend about our freight industry and learned a few things, including how, first of all, I guess, how extensive it is in this country, but also the fact that a freight train replaces something like 280 trucks, imagining trucks carrying some of this toxic material. Why do trains carry this toxic material? What is the benefit of a train doing this versus a truck?
It's tremendously more safe.
In spite of what we've been talking about.
Yes. The risk of a highway crash and release in the highway is much greater than the risk of a rail crash and release on the rail. And in fact, many chemicals, I don't know if this is one included, you cannot carry in a truck tank. You can carry them on a truck in some other container, but you see tank trucks around hauling, you know, diesel fuel and gasoline. Many chemicals, that's against the law because of the risk. Mm. You know, this is a pretty, on my scale, a more of a benign chemical than some of the stuff that the railroads move. You know, chlorine, as an example, is a toxic inhalation hazard. And generally, the railroads, if they have a lot of the really nasty chemicals, will not do it on a line that there's some question of maintenance somewhere, because it's the liability risk is just too great.
But are they required to tell a town that they might go through that they're carrying toxic materials, for instance?
Yeah, I don't know the rules on that. I don't think so. They regularly meet with the first responders to tell them things like that. The train crew knows exactly what's on each train and has instructions for emergency response. The AR and Chemtrak maintain centers for responding to stuff like this. But, you know, there's a lot of chemicals moving, different types, and it becomes very difficult then to keep everybody informed of exactly what's where all the time. Plus, there's some national security concerns. You know, if information of exactly what chemical is where is made available on a wide basis, then people who might seek to do harm by sabotaging a train would have that knowledge as well.
This is a part of the country, Paul, where there are a number of factories and chemical industry. I mean, it's part of New Jersey's chemical heritage.
Clearly, the freight rail system is important to the commerce of New Jersey, to the commerce of the country. So, freight trains have to move through populated areas, and they have to carry the chemicals that are necessary for these industrial operations to do their work. So you've got a lot of things that have to happen, and the goal is to make them be safe.
I would also add, you know, in particular, chlorine is used in municipalities for water purification. So, you know, some of these chemicals, their uses go beyond just industry.
Let me get, looks like Bryn from North Philadelphia to join us. Bryn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, it just brings back family memories. My father was a chemist in Paulsboro, New Jersey in 1946 and worked on developing vinyl chloride, processing that on floor covering to make the modern floor coverings that are much more stainless, scrubless, whatever, than the old sort of like more like tar paper floor coverings that they had pre-World War II. And I was born in 1947, 65 years ago, with an undescended testicle. And years later, they discovered that that was a birth defect passed on by workers who were exposed to vinyl chloride. So my father would be at work working with it, come home, live with my mother, and then I, as an embryo, fetus, whatever, baby, was damaged by that. And so we are dealing with things when they talk about cost, that the expense may not be known for years. And certainly I hope this is considered in terms of future railroad safety and in terms of the cleanup for the town of Paulsboro, New Jersey.
Well, Bryn, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Very interesting and important call. Peter, anything you want to add to that? Peter Swan?
No, you know, other than, you know, thankfully, I think the response was adequate to minimize the exposure, in this case, at least.
Let me see what looks like David from Souderton has to say. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you very much. I just wanted to mention, I had been the international director of nuclear safety for a very large couple of years ago before I retired. And I'm also one of the people that was responsible for the writing of OSHA requirements. One of the problems you have is one of complacency. When nothing goes wrong for a long time, we just get very set in our ways. And when you ask companies to self-regulate, as in this case, you're going to have a problem because management wants to make profit, and you don't make profit by having lengthy inspections over and over again and replacing what needs to be replaced. It's the state of the world, and unless you have other people doing it, you're going to have a problem. If we did not have the USDA inspecting meats, we would be in serious trouble.
Well, David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Can I toss that to you, Paul Nussbaum?
I think what he says makes a lot of sense, that there needs to be and is, to a certain extent, oversight that is independent. The self-interest that's involved and the collision between safety interests and money-making interests, that tension is pretty great, and there needs to be a referee that says, no, this bridge needs to be fixed now before another train can go over it.
Do you agree with that, Peter Swan?
Well, you know, certainly there's a role for federal oversight. Thus far, it's in making rules and then finding railroads that don't follow the rules. You know, there are many rules that are followed scrupulously because railroads have to keep records of what they do, and those records can be looked at, and if they fail to do what they're supposed to, they get fined. You know, I can think of several instances. And the one thing you run into that gets into the mix that's troublesome is, you know, another example is we had a collision between a freight train and a commuter train out in California, and as a result, the federal government has mandated that many of the rail lines have positive train control installed on them, which is a system which will automatically stop a train before it passes a red signal in case the engineer falls asleep or something like that. And there's a lot of give and take on that because there are some lines that simply do not earn enough revenue to justify the installation of the system on them. So the very real danger of that law is that many areas that now have freight service will lose it.
But even going back to Paulsboro and using that as an example, who do you think, and this is to you, Peter Swan, do you think the freight company, perhaps Conrail or CSX, are they going to pick up the tab, or are they going to turn to the federal government, the state government, the local government, and say, this is going to be your problem?
I'm confident they'll pick up the tab.
The whole thing?
Yeah.
Because it's the right thing to do, or it's good PR, or because it's their job?
It's their job, and also the law kind of is going to make them pick it up. You're not going to see Conrail going into bankruptcy. It's too important for both Norfolk Southern and CSX. Plus, you know, that's their job to make people whole when they have an accident. It's their fault.
Mm. I was reading the American Society of Civil Engineers writing about the railroad industry needs $200 billion in investments by 2035 to meet the demand. That's a quote there. Peter Swan, if we're talking about $200 billion to improve the system, again, do you think that'll fall on the companies themselves?
Well, you have to understand what that number is. There was an earlier study that predicted freight would double in volume between 2010 and 20, or 2000 and 2020, I think it was. And those projections are still pretty much there, even though there's been a drop in freight. And that projection was in reference to expanding the rail system to haul increased freight that people thought was going to be moving, not to bring it up to better standards. It was just to add lines to haul more freight. Now, where's that money coming from? I don't think anybody knows. The industry is making enough money now that they can finance a significant amount of expansion and have been doing that. I think they spent $6 billion in capital improvements last year, which is a lot. But there's more that's going to be needed, and I suspect there may be some public-private partnerships in the future to expand areas where it's difficult to find the private money. It's hard to say.
I was reading again, and many things I did not know about the freight industry. I'll toss this back to you, Peter Swan, which is that freight carries something like 40% of our stuff around the country. Did I read that right?
Well, if you're talking about the stuff that gets carried, I mean, technically it's all freight. And so I'm not quite sure what that number is, but I will tell you, you know, it's something like tons per person is significant. And the other thing that's puzzled me about freight for the last few years is the amount of ton miles, which is the measure of freight, one ton moved a mile, has been increasing per person, you know, pretty steadily over the last couple decades. So, you know, we're not eating that much more food, although it would have seemed we are eating
more.
We
might be, yes.
We're not buying that much more stuff. Flat screen TVs weigh less than the old ones, but yet there's more stuff moving around, and it's kind of mystifying to me as to why that is. It may be importing from China. It may be something else.
Going back to you, Paul, and then we'll get back to our final caller here, but as you followed this story, what questions hung out for you?
Well, I guess the big one is the obvious one, is why would the railroad not have paid a little more attention to this bridge sooner. The last required mechanical inspection that was supposed to be done in September apparently didn't get done, despite 9 or 10 reports of problems on that bridge in the last month. The fixes clearly didn't get made. So those are the questions that stick out in my mind: is why wasn't the bridge taken better care of in the most recent past?
And do you think this reports come out that will answer those questions?
Well, the NTSB,
time will tell.
The NTSB does good work, but it takes its time. So yeah, we'll find out in about a year.
Well, let's find out what John from Ballykinwood has to say. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
That line serves a number of refineries and chemical industries along the Delaware River. And once the train is south of Woodbury, it's on a stub-end line. There are no alternate rail routes. So I was wondering what is being done to mitigate shipments to and from these industries in order to avoid shutdowns and further economic impact.
It's a good question. John, I guess I'm back at you, Paul Nussbaum. Do you know?
Well, I've heard.
Kind of a workaround, I guess?
Yeah, I've heard that some of the shipments have been replaced by barge and truck traffic to the extent that it can be, and some of it will just have to be stored in place until they can make shipments.
Anything you want to add to that, Peter Swan?
No, that sounds about right.
And from your perspective, Peter, I mean, is this we've been talking about the Paulsboro accident, but is this an aberration? Is this how we should think about freight industry, or how do you, I guess, what kind of context do you put this accident in?
Well, two things. This line is not a high density main line, so clearly there are lighter density lines that there may be need for more public money to retain rail service long term. The other thing I'll say is Conrail is an institution, as a corporation, is kind of a funny place. It's owned by two railroads, and its purpose was to provide access to both CSX and NS without any favoritism. And you know, you keep hearing instances where that may not be a great way to run a corporation, to have two masters. And you know, one thing that might come out of this is CSX and NS may look at it and say, you know, we need to split it up and have each of us operate these pieces rather than Conrail exist as a separate entity and guarantee access to each other.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Peter Swan, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
He's Assistant Professor of Logistics and Operations Management at Penn State at the Harrisburg campus. Paul Nussbaum, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
And Paul Nussbaum is a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, has been covering the Paulsboro train accident for the paper. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including things like Facebook and Twitter, email, and the archives. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, it's Voices in the Family with your host, Dr. Dan Gottlieb.